Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chimanchi, and I'm joined tonight by my co-host Sam Mazur and our producer, Trevor Hogue. What's up, guys?
Hey, Chris.
Hi, guys.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Nimish Patel, here to discuss retinopathy of prematurity. But before we set our focus on today's topic, Sam, remind us what the show is about.
I would love to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
Today, we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Nimish Patel. Dr. Patel is a vitreoretinal surgeon specializing in pediatric retina with a focus on retinopathy of prematurity. He serves as the director of pediatric retina at Mass Eye and Ear and is passionate about digital media and online education. Through platforms like Vitreoretinal Surgery Online, the AJO podcast, and social media, he advances global surgical education and promotes accessible, innovative approaches to learning in ophthalmology. Today, he teaches us the screening guidelines for ROP, how we approach treatment and management, and the long-term visual potential for our ROP patients.
We have an amazing discussion today, but before our intro dilates any further, we should get into it.
Oh, I see. I gotcha.
That was good.
I was trying to figure out how to say it out. I had like the idea that came together right at the end. Dr. Patel, thank you for coming on the show. First, because we're an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Yes, of course.
Is Nimish correct?
Yes.
Excellent. So let's start to just get to know you a little better. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe something you like outside of medicine?
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. I'm an ophthalmologist by training. I did my medical school in Boston at Tufts University, as well as residency at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute in Miami. I then did a retina fellowship and found myself in pediatric retina after having a really good mentor who pushed me in this direction and finding out it was a great area for research and helping patients. And so now I work at the Mass Eye and Ear in Boston, as well as Boston Children's Hospital, doing both adult and pediatric retina surgery. Outside of work, I like to travel. I like sports. The fun fact is I was born in New Zealand, so I still like rugby, even though I'm too small and not athletic enough to play it. But one day, I'm still young.
Well, look, Chris, we got another MedPeds folk. We didn't even know that was coming on. This is fantastic. He does adult and pediatrics, but here we're focusing on the pediatric side, which is all good. Maybe I'll ask the next question. Although I do want to hear more about rugby, but maybe we'll talk about that later. Our favorite question that we ask kind of all our guests on the show, what is your favorite failure and what did you learn?
Yeah, I've had probably too many failures, but that's good because that's many lessons. But I think one that spurred a change in my practice and a change in the way I document is when I was in residency and you're learning everything is new. And it's quite hard to figure out what's actually novel and or just new to you. And there were many cases I saw that could have been case reports or publishable or really interesting surgical videos. And I didn't always take the time to download the video or document the patient's MRN. And then I'd see something very strange later on, just like that patient, ask around and they say, wow, that's really cool or novel. And I said, well, I actually saw two other things like that. And so now actually I keep a list of all new patients. And that has helped me both in research and just in practice and patient care. Being able to look up patients on your own list at a drop of a hat really helps also with referrals. When a referring doctor messages you and says, how's my patient doing? You say, well, let me see. And you look it up and you can tell them. So now documenting each of your own patients, it takes a little bit of work every time you see a new patient to add them to some list. But that was kind of some failures I had, and it's changed the way I practice a little bit.
Awesome. That's a tip I've heard from. I don't know if you guys know about Gurpreet Dhaliwal is. They always call him the sort of the modern day Sherlock Holmes. He's an internist over at UCSF, I believe, and he's just an amazing like teacher and educator, and he's great. He teaches people how to like learn about concepts and clinical reasoning, and also, that's one of the things he does is he keeps a really distinct case of all of the patients he's seen, follows them up, and things like that. So that's a great tip.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that either, and I'm storing that away in the back of my mind for as an intern. So,
oh, nice. I hadn't heard of that either. So there we go. Advice and validated. This is fantastic. All right, Trevor, you want to ask the next one?
Yeah, I was going to ask, what is your favorite book that you've ever read? Doesn't have to be medicine related.
Oh, that's a tough one. I can at least think of one recently that was interesting to me. I have to say, unfortunately, I've put reading away. I used to read a lot of books, and now I really focus on work, children, life. You really have to pare down your interests and focus on what's important to you. And I figured out work and children and family are probably the two most important. So, and sports. So I watch a lot of sports, and then reading has gone by the wayside, unfortunately. Also with all the easy to consume short content on YouTube and Netflix, suddenly reading is less enjoyable. But a recent book I read was it's called A Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And it was about Holocaust survivors. And his central thesis is that you can actually gain a lot by suffering, and you can find meaning. And those people who survived the Holocaust actually found meaning in small things and had a renewed sense of purpose throughout life. So his general thesis that I think can be applied to all of medicine is that there is meaning in certain things. And if you can find some meaning in whatever you do in the day-to-day, it can help you progress and not get burnt out. So there's quite a lot of lessons to take from this book that even in times of trauma or difficulty, there is some positives and meaning, and that can help you as you get out of the trauma to look back on that time and see what was important and what now you're more appreciative of.
That's like very impactful. Going to add that to my Goodreads want to read list right after this.
Perfect. All right. We got some good advice. We got some good failures. We got some good books. We got all the above. Thank you for sharing, for sure. And I think we should get into this content, though, because we got a great, great couple questions that we want to ask you. Trevor, you mind getting us started? Hey, Cripsiders listeners. Are you a pediatrician ready to focus on what matters most, your patients? Well, the Permanente Medical Group in Northern California is seeking pediatric physicians to join their multidisciplinary practice, serving families across 21 medical centers with an 80-year legacy of excellence. So here's what sets them apart. No RVUs, no billing headaches, no practice overhead, just you providing exceptional care in a physician-led, mission-driven environment. They offer flexible schedules, a competitive salary and benefits package, moving and relocation assistance, and Northern California home buying assistance. Plus, they are PSLF eligible. Whether you're drawn to Northern California's natural beauty, year-round recreational amenities, or vibrant communities, they have locations you'll love to call home. Visit northerncalifornia.permanente.org to learn how you can help them fulfill the promise of medicine at Kaiser Permanente Northern California. Again, that's northerncalifornia.permanente.org.
So here at Cash Like Children's, we have Austin. He is a 28-week-old male admitted to the NICU following an emergency section for maternal eclampsia. Mom says this was her first pregnancy, and she had routine prenatal care leading up to her unexpected delivery. He was 3 pounds at birth and is currently intubated for neonatal respiratory distress syndrome requiring supplemental oxygen. The parents have been counseled on potential problems encountered by his preterm delivery, one of which being retinopathy of prematurity, and that he will soon need an eye exam. They are very concerned and specifically ask more about what his vision will be like down the line or if he's going to go blind one day. So the parents in this case, very rightfully worried about their newborn. They've just had a lot going on. But can we take a few steps back and talk about some ophthalmology basics for our listeners to help with this conversation we have about ROP?
Yes, and the tricky part about ophthalmology is we get about 1 week of course in medical school, and then you go to residency and you basically are learning a brand new condition, diseases from scratch. So I hear where you're coming from. And it's not abnormal to not know any parts of the eye, even if you've graduated medical school. So don't feel bad, anybody who's listening to this podcast, if you don't know the difference between an iris and an olecranon. So the usually front to back is the way we approach it with patients. And the cornea we call the windshield of the eye, or the surface of the camera. That's usually the front part of the eye, the clear part. Then you have the anterior chamber, which is between the cornea and the iris, which is the colored portion of the eye that constricts and dilates. Right posterior to that is the lens, which again functions quite like a camera in an analogy. So that can change shape and focus light onto the retina, which is the back part of the eye. And the analogy there is the film of the camera, although nowadays everyone has digital cameras, so this analogy is getting outdated. But the film of the camera is essentially the retina. That's how the eye is formed. In between the lens and the retina, there's the vitreous cavity. It's composed of a gel at a young age, and as you get older, it's more of a liquid portion. It's about 4 millimeters cubed in volume. And then the retina has the optic nerve in the center, which connects to the brain, as well as blood vessels that come out of the optic nerve and perfuse the retina. The center of the retina, where most of the vision comes from, is the macula and the fovea. So that's where we talk about the meaningful vision. And then you have the retinal periphery, which is included for night vision and peripheral vision, but doesn't really contribute a lot to central visual acuity. So that's the overall basics for the eye. As we talk about retinopathy of prematurity or screening for retinopathy of prematurity, we are looking at the back part of the eye, the retina, and specifically the blood vessels, how they're growing to the periphery of the eye. Just to mention as an overview of other things you may see as a pediatrician or a neonatologist, conjunctivitis affects the front part of the eye. Sometimes you can get corneal clouding in storage diseases. You can get congenital cataracts in certain conditions like Down syndrome or rubella, torch infections. And then in the retina, things to look out for are colobomas of the retina or abnormal red reflexes if you shine a light in the eye. As you get older, things that we worry about are retinoblastomas or tumors of the retina, and that can present as a white reflex. So those are kind of the broad overview of common conditions of the eye and eyeball in the pediatric space. But in this one, we're talking more about the retinal vasculature.
So say you're talking to a parent and we're trying to explain retinopathy of prematurity. How would you best explain it to a layman, and maybe best for me, since sometimes I need things a little easier to understand?
Yes, we do try to frame it within areas of other parts of the body that may be easier to understand. So we say, okay, your baby is due at around 40 weeks, and you were born now, this patient, at 28 weeks. Just like the rest of the body is still growing, the eye is still growing. And we don't really focus too close on what parts and why, but we say, the eye is still growing and developing. And within that, the blood vessels that help the eye grow are still maturing, and they usually mature around 40 weeks of gestational age or term. And in the meantime, sometimes the oxygen that helps the baby survive can actually suppress or decrease the blood vessel growth, because the eye says, I have enough oxygen, I don't need to grow these blood vessels. And then secondarily, sometimes you get abnormal blood vessel growth because the eye, as the oxygen goes away, says, wow, I need more oxygen. And so the blood vessels grow fast, and then sometimes they grow too fast and cause bleeding and pulling on the retina. So that's usually the way we describe it. Retinopathy of prematurity is really a two-phase disease with a vaso-obliterative portion with too much oxygen, and then a vaso-proliferative phase with too little oxygen and these angiogenic growth factors. So we usually describe it in that way, where the retina is not mature, the blood vessels are still growing, and the oxygen sometimes can limit the growth. And then as it's pulled away, there can be essentially overgrowth of the blood vessels, and we monitor for that and can actually slow that down with treatment if we need to.
Awesome. You know, I would just say right off the bat, didn't know that, right? That this is a two-stage disease process with two different kind of physiology mechanisms. Would you mind kind of walking us through the timeline, so to speak, of when those things are supposed to happen, and then obviously when the pathophysiology kind of comes in?
Yeah, so it can be a little bit variable depending on the gestational age, but usually the conversion from this phase one to phase two is around 32 to 34 weeks. And that usually coincides with, as you can probably tell me better, maybe the development of the lungs and decrease in oxygen supplementation. That's often times where patients go from being intubated to CPAP to room air. And as that oxygen is getting peeled off, that's when the vasoproliferation occurs. And there's a host of different pro-angiogenic growth factors that come in, the most important being vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. That's the one you'll probably hear a lot about. But there's others that are involved, Ang2, among others, that can lead to that vasoproliferation. But the crossover time is usually, as the oxygen is peeled away, around 32 to 34 weeks.
Awesome. So just for clarification's sake, when we're talking about the two-step pathophys behind ROP, I feel like I've gotten asked this question maybe on every single board exam that I've taken. So it's not just prematurity, it's prematurity combined with oxygen exposure.
Correct. And so we see that actually in different parts of the world. They have very different rates of retinopathy of prematurity. And not only that, different ages at which they present. So in the United States and developed countries and high-income GDP countries, we have good oxygen protocols where we can actually limit the amount of oxygen, and we have the resources to be able to titrate the oxygen in specific windows. And therefore, some of our patients are not getting retinopathy of prematurity who are born later, while in lower and middle-income countries, these patients, they don't have the resources, and they have to just turn up the oxygen to keep them alive. And even higher gestational age patients will get retinopathy of prematurity even outside of the screening window in the U.S., where patients will usually screen less than 30 weeks, like your patient in this example. But in other countries where the oxygen is high, even 31, 32, 33-week babies will get retinopathy of prematurity because there's so much oxygen at play.
So our patient in this case is intubated with supplemental oxygen. Is there like an acceptable level or, you know, use that we could be giving these NICU babies? Like, is there a maximum that we should be being more cognizant of?
Yeah, there's usually some protocols for this based on the NICU. And usually it's 91 to 96, 91 to 94. And of course, it depends on the systemic factors of the patient. Number one is we want to keep them alive. We can actually usually treat a lot of retinopathy prematurity. There are very few patients who are actually going blind if they're being monitored closely, especially with some of our new treatments like anti-VEGF growth factor injections have really changed the game. So we always defer to the neonatologists, the pediatricians, and say, you do whatever you need to do to keep the patient alive, but we can fix the retinopathy. But the targets are these 91 to 96s.
Okay. So that kind of gets into our next topic of discussion. Who exactly gets screened for ROP? Like, what are the screening guidelines? In this case, our patient, he's a 28-week-old. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and these are important to know because it's actually usually the neonatologists or the pediatricians who flag this and order the screen for retinopathy of prematurity. So there are now electronic medical records or Epic that can automatically flag some of this, but usually it is down to the neonatologist. These are also very high-risk medical legal cases, so it's important to kind of be aware of these and make sure the patients are getting screened and followed up. The current guidelines are less than 1,500 grams or less than 30 weeks gestational age, or if there's some other high-risk factors that are concerning, these include sepsis, prolonged oxygen exposure, maybe twin gestation is a risk factor for ROP. And so whatever else the neonatologist may deem slightly concerning or highly metabolically active or highly consumptive in terms of oxygen. Those may prompt screening outside of those windows slightly, but those are the current guidelines. It's a little bit complicated, but we usually screen at 31 weeks or 4 weeks after birth, whichever is later. So meaning that if you're born at 27 weeks, we'll screen at 31 weeks. If you're born at 26, you screen at 31. If you're born at 25, you screen at 31. But if you're born at 28, you screen at 32. So it's 31 or 4 weeks after birth, whichever is later. Now I'll give a little primer on this. So we've been doing a lot of research and we're actually working with the American Academy of Pediatrics to change the guidelines or risk tailor the guidelines. So this guideline is actually applied across all patients who meet the screening criteria. However, 23-week babies, which we weren't seeing 30, 40 years ago, but has now become more prevalent as survivability increases, they have a much higher risk of retinopathy of prematurity. While in the modern era with strict oxygen protocols in the United States, a 30-week baby or 31-week baby who may be 1,400 grams is almost really never going to get ROP. And we've done some research on these. And do they really need to be screened at 34 weeks and 36 weeks and 38 weeks? So our research is actually centering on a little bit more risk tailoring approach where maybe some of these patients could be screened right before discharge one time or even as an outpatient, the very low risk patients, while keeping the high risk patients screened early and often. But currently there is one guideline and one criteria for all patients in the risk cohort. And if you're wondering about, well, then how does this patient get screened after? Usually we see high-risk patients every week and low-risk patients every other week. So you can anticipate that frequency. The screening continues usually until about 40 weeks when the retina vessels are fully vascularized, or a little bit longer if there's any concerns.
And then would you mind just walking us through your screening exam as well?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing, and all the nurses hate it. Everybody who likes babies hates watching them getting their eye exams, so I don't know what that says about me, but what we do is we actually first put a dilating drop, so we use a few different dilating drops to dilate the pupil. That takes about 30 minutes to an hour, so usually those have to be administered about 30 minutes to an hour before the ophthalmologist will come. We then use proparacaine, which is a numbing eye drop, to help numb the eyes. We put a speculum in the eye to open it. And then we take a look with a lens and a light source and examine the retina. As you get going, these exams are actually pretty quick. So they take about 1 to 2 minutes per eye, if that. And you can usually get enough information in those short time. So it's actually a pretty quick exam. There is actually a lot of new ways to screen retinopathy of prematurity that's on the horizon, and telemedicine is a very common one now. So coming to a NICU near you probably is telemedicine screening, and in which case the nurses are actually taking photos of the eye with a contact camera and remote sending it to an ROP specialist to read the exam. Now, it doesn't give you as much information. You don't see the periphery of the eye, but the way that ROP works is that if you really have severe or treatable disease, it's usually in the center part of the retina. So if you can't see that the retina has vascularized past, let's say, midway or what we call zone 2, you should be able to see that with the camera. So a lot of recent studies have actually demonstrated that telemedicine can show you enough of what you need to see, and it can actually help with the resource problem and having an ophthalmologist need to come to the NICU. So it's a common thing that we're doing. We've actually started doing this at our own hospital with satellite hospitals. And it's helped a lot because then the main center can actually keep the beds open for patients who are higher risk from a systemic standpoint. And then the patients who are from these communities can actually stay at home and be closer with their baby and not have to travel to come see their baby in the main center NICU. And then from a financial perspective, it's actually quite beneficial because these community hospitals who may be less filled are able to actually keep the baby in their NICU when they didn't have ROP screening prior and able to actually raise the level of their NICU. So it's a win-win-win across the board as long as we can maintain safety. But that's how babies are being screened now, either in person or telemedicine.
And just out of curiosity, from a research standpoint, what was our sensitivity for retinopathy of prematurity with the, you know, with the in-person, you know, exam, whether it be, you know, different ophthalmologists across the board? So it's clearly a, you know, roughly subjective situation from that standpoint. Like, what was our sensitivity to begin with? And then if we did telehealth, did our sensitivity change at all? Is it slightly worse, slightly better? You know, kind of where did you guys end up from a numbers standpoint?
Yeah, the sensitivity in-person exam is essentially 100 because that's the gold standard. Now, there are times where you cannot see that well. The pupil then dilate if there's some bleeding in the eye. As the eye actually develops, so does the view to the back of the eye. So the cornea and the vitreous that we talked about actually are pretty hazy, and the eye is very small. Sometimes there's a CPAP on the eye, CPAP on the nose that gets in the way. So that you may not get a perfect view every time, but usually the in-person sensitivity is very good. The studies have shown up to 99 to 100% sensitivity and specificity, but that's more been in the U.S. and more in the last decade. The initial reports and some of the international studies were closer to 90%, which is really not good enough. It has to be 100%.
Yeah.
But because the resources are so limited in some of these areas, even getting 90 to 100% is better than not having anybody screened at all. So that's really where things are probably heading for lower resource areas. And it allows ROP experts to look at the photos and people who are used to seeing it.
So this brings me to a question with my, you know, my adult primary care brain is functioning at the moment. And, you know, in my primary care setting for some of our diabetics, we're looking at diabetic retinopathy. There are machines that not only take pictures, but also AI does a run as well in terms of trying to detect retinopathy in those patients, especially when we're talking about limited resource areas. Is this something that is also being investigated?
Yes, so you're 100% correct. In diabetic retinopathy, there's even a company that's FDA approved called IDX that can screen diabetic retinopathy. Some of the downsides of this is who's responsible for that data. So let's say it comes up with a positive. Who's now obligated to call the patient or tell them what to do? The other issues associated with that is what if they're missing something else? So maybe they call no diabetic retinopathy, but they miss an eye cancer or glaucoma or something else. So there are some limitations to the AI, but let's say you put this in a diabetic clinic, it could be quite helpful. And we're actually doing some of that same research on sickle cell retinopathy, where you can get bleeding in the retina associated with sickle cell disease. And it would be really nice if you can use AI to detect this in a hematology clinic where all the patients are and they don't need separate appointments. There is actually a lot of studies in retinopathy of prematurity. It's a prime disease for AI. It's picture-based. Everything's coded. There are stages. So it's really prime for AI. It's funny because even in retina, like radiology, it's a very imaging-heavy specialty. And when I was in residency, I was going to these conferences, and we would have half a day of the conference be on AI, and everyone's saying, oh my goodness, we're all going to be out of a job by the time we finish. And it hasn't really hit yet. And the questions are why. I think there's a few limitations. Number one is the training sets are not always the same as the testing sets. There are different cameras. And a lot of the studies are done with post-image processing. So yes, the AI is really good if you tune up all the pictures. But if you're not able to do that and you test it on something else, you may not get the same sensitivity and specificity. With that said, I am surely positive that within 5 to 10 years, AI should be pretty good at ROP detection. And in conjunction with humans, it should be very good. And so I think what's going to happen is the future of ROP screening is probably telemedicine coupled with AI, coupled with a final reader who maybe gets screened out patients by the AI or screened in patients by the AI, to limit the amount of work that has to be done per patient. But I think that's where we are heading at some point. It's just not quite there yet.
Cool. So I'm just going to try to summarize just where we talked about from the screening algorithm. And then I just want to make sure we're not missing anything. So who are we getting screened? We're getting any patient who is essentially small, less than 1500 grams, patient who's born early, who's got a two in front, essentially, or really less than 32 weeks, who has other risk factors for oxygen consumption. We are getting at 31 weeks or 4 weeks after birth, whichever is later, we're getting an ophthalmologist to do an exam. And if we possibly don't have an ophthalmologist, we might be getting a telehealth kind of picture exam, which can be done to see. We're doing that exam. It sounds like we're doing that exam weekly through up to 40 weeks. And an ophthalmology decides whether it's going to be weekly or every other week, depending on how good things look. But essentially getting that stuff weekly up until the blood vessels go into the retina completely develop. Am I missing anything for the screening guidelines? Although it sounds like AAP might update in the future, but for right, say right now, am I missing anything in the screening guidelines?
Yeah, that's 100% correct. Just to add into what we counsel the patients, there's a few other terms I like to use. And I think when the baby is in the NICU, hearing the word normal is really nice for the parents. So I always say, this is normal for their current age. Or yes, the blood vessels may not be finished, and so we're not done with screening. But at your age, everything is normal. And I think that's been, over time, I've learned that to be one of my favorite reassuring words, even in the NICU, but actually in pediatrics in general. So if I see a pediatric patient with some sort of systemic disease, you know, we screen patients for spinal muscular atrophy on Ristoplam, which is a new medication, and they can potentially get retinal toxicity. They get really relieved when you say the eyes are normal.
Whether this is your first episode or you've been listening to us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a pediatrician, FIGS. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in FIGS scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV, yep, they're in FIGS too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that FIGS are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine 50 plus times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with FIGS. Now Cribsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX for 15% off.
So I think the next question I'd like to ask, and this is a question we try to make sure that we at least touch upon in every one of our episodes, because it's so important and I think it's often overlooked. You know, what types of social drivers do we see in retinopathy of prematurity? I think you already discussed a little bit how you do see difference in rates based on, you know, in different countries, but just within the US, like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's actually a few. So number one, we had actually done a research project looking in injections for retinopathy of prematurity and looking at outcomes. So that was just the initial goal of the project. And actually, the first goal was just to look at practice patterns. How are people doing the injections? What frequency? When are they seeing the patient back? And so we reached out to our whole network of pediatric retina specialists and developed the largest real-world study to date. It had about 1,600 injections. And then when we analyzed the data, the funny thing that came up was that a large majority of them were male, over 60%. And that was odd. And we said, well, that's... And I said, okay, let's run the stats on that. Is that significant? Because it really should be 50-50. And then we found that it was significant. And that actually led us to a meta-analysis. So then we looked at all studies with retinopathy of prematurity, some smaller, and we pulled the statistics and actually found that they had the same finding, that actually males are treated more for ROP than females. And then when we looked into some of the data, in the neonatology literature is that there is potentially a fragility of males relative to females in the neonatal period. Now, we don't know exactly about survivability. It's possible that in other countries, males survive more, potentially by selection. But we do know that more males are treated for retinopathy than females. We don't know exactly the cause, but it seems that more males meet the treatment criteria than females, which is interesting. Then the other thing that we found is we've looked at demographics, including racial demographics and socioeconomic demographics. There's a couple scores we use called the Child Opportunity Index and the ADI, the Area Deprivation Index. So we're doing studies on this currently. What we found is that there is a higher risk of microprematurity and treatment in those patients and parents who have low socioeconomic indexes and opportunity. However, actually, when you control for the level of prematurity itself, there's no difference. So what we're finding there is that the level of prematurity is mostly associated with the socioeconomics, but once you get to that level of prematurity, it seems like the care is equal, which means that we really need to go out and educate and help prevent prematurity in these areas, which, again, is probably up to your guys' area of expertise, but I don't know if you have any insight onto why this is happening, but it may be due to younger pregnancies, I think, was one of the driving factors, illicit substance abuse, and things of this nature in those populations that drive higher prematurity. And unfortunately, these patients, as they get older, have more disadvantages. So once you're more premature, there may be slightly lower cognition. They may be slightly poor vision from retinopathy and other neuropsychosocial effects. And if you're in an area of difficulty to begin with, you get a little bit further behind. So that's one thing we're finding, is that retinopathy and prematurity disproportionately affects these patients, usually because of the prematurity. And it's important to set up these support systems and understand that this is happening as you go forward. And these neonates become pediatric patients and become young adults and become school-age children and becomes college students.
It seems like this tracks along what we kind of would know and would guess. You know, this is a disease of prematurity, right? We're calling it retinopathy of prematurity. And then that follows with what are risk factors for prematurity. And we do know there's a lot of socioeconomic and social determinants of health that drive this. Some of the structural issues that go on in our country have led us to have people who are disadvantaged have more frequently have premature births. And if that's the case, it would seem more likely that they would also have retinopathy of prematurity that would go along with, as if you're born young, you have oxygen issues and things kind of track. So that makes sense. And exactly, you're putting it back to us to be like, all right, guys, let's try to do our best to at least bring it out to everybody to say, hey, what can we do big picture to hopefully not be delivering premature babies all the time. And to our NICU colleagues, although they are amazing at keeping very, very, very premature infants alive, I'm sure they would also be happy if there were fewer premature infants out there. And I'm sure they'll still have plenty of jobs.
Yeah, and I think the other key point is this actually extends into adulthood. So we just did a study looking at one of the NEI databases, the Wonder database, and as well as the All of Us database. And these are databases where many different inputs are put in, including food insecurity, transportation issues. And it's mainly based on adults, but we looked up pediatric retinal conditions such as ROP and compared them to adult retinal conditions, even in the same age group like diabetic retinopathy. And we found that these pediatric conditions are associated with worse social determinants of health, partially because they probably had these their whole lives. And if you start behind, it's harder to get ahead. And that's where kind of making sure these supports run up through the pediatric age to get them to a certain point especially after they leave the care of their parents, or maybe their parents are no longer able to take care of these patients, what is happening to them and how can we support them through adulthood?
So when we're moving on, so we've screened, we talked about screening, we're moving on to our treatment and management. Can you talk to us about kind of like the different stages of ROP, like we mentioned kind of at the beginning anatomically, and then what typically would these interventions be for these patients?
Yeah. So the staging system is somewhat important, but there's really a threshold of treatment or no treatment. That's really the most important. And I think the clinically meaningful is vision loss or no vision loss. And so for retina specialists of ophthalmologists, we have a stage 1 through 5, stage 1 being a ridge or demarcation line, stage 2 being a ridge, stage 3 being blood vessels on the ridge, and stage 4 being a partial retinal detachment, and stage 5 being a full retinal detachment. So what does all that mean? The ridges are really the border between the vascularized retina and the avascular retina. So if you're seeing that there's a demarcation between these areas, that's a sign that the retina may not perfuse further as you get older. And if you see blood vessels on that ridge, that's a sign of shunting and this overgrowth of the blood vessels that we're seeing. And so the question is, well, how do you get a retinal detachment from there? And how do you progress from the stage 3 to stage 4? And that's where the vitreous gel comes in. So the vitreous gel in young patients is very thick. And what happens is these blood vessels, they actually grow up into the vitreous and start to pull on the retina towards the cornea or the front part of the eye. So instead of the retinal vessels being flat, they now start to gain this vertical component. And that's when the retina pulls away from the back of the eye. And that's where it starts to lose its blood supply and the retinal cells lose their viability. And that's how you get vision loss. So when do you treat patients? It's usually when you start to see these abnormal blood vessels grow. So usually within stage 3, and especially if the blood vessels have not grown very far, we use zones to determine that. Zone 1 being very central, zone 3 being more peripheral. So we usually treat in zone 1 or stage 3, or if there's a lot of vessel engorgement suggesting overgrowth of the vessels or shunting. There's two kind of main treatment options available, and it's important to understand because we're in a flux. The historical treatments were more destructive, which was actually ablating the peripheral retina with either a freezing treatment or a laser. And now we have these more medical treatments, an anti-VEGF monoclonal antibody that can decrease the vasoproliferation from a medical standpoint. The laser, the way it works, it's a little bit complicated to explain, but it's actually the same in diabetic retinopathy. And so it's good to understand just how this works. It's the abnormal or partially perfused retina that's usually responsible for sending out this pro-angiogenic factors or proteins. And so ablating that peripheral retina actually stops that drive. So we're not, a common misconception is actually that we're ablating the blood vessels themselves. That's not correct. We're ablating the partially dead or dying retina that's sending out the signals to make those blood vessels, which then regress. The downsides of the laser treatment is it is destructive. So if there's a very small amount of the retina developed, destroying the peripheral retina can lead to peripheral retinal vision loss or even inflammation or scar tissue formation of the retina. The better factor of this is that it is permanent. So if you have a patient that you're worried about loss to follow-up or concerns about how they're going to come back to the clinic or how they're going to be monitored, it's a more permanent solution. The anti-VEGF injections, some of the downsides there is that it is an injection into the eye. We inject it through the pars plana, which is thankfully an area of the eye about 3 millimeters away from the cornea where there are limited blood vessels, there's no retina, and it is some magical place where you can inject the eye and you don't run into any abnormal effects if you put the needle in. You don't hit the lens, you don't hit the retina, and it's a very small space, but it's easy to find. And the downside is there's a very low risk of infection. The reported rates in adults is about 1 in 10,000. It's pretty rare, even in pediatric patients. There have been isolated case reports. In our series of 1,600 patients, we didn't see any, but it's probably about the same, 1 in 5,000, 1 in 10,000. So that's one of the downsides that we talk about. Also, the fact that it wears off usually lasts about 8 to 12 weeks and may need to be re-injected, or at least the patient needs to be followed for reactivation as the medication wears off. The common practice pattern now, which part of our study was looking at this, is that a lot of patients are being injected first, lasered later. So what we do is we use the injections first as a temporizing measure. We let the blood vessels grow out a little bit further and then try to minimize the area we have to laser. So we try to decrease the angiogenic drive just enough to promote some blood vessel growth. And then we laser the patient at around age 55 to 60 weeks. And you may say, well, why that age? The questions are, is that number one, they get hard to examine at that age. The laser has to be done usually under anesthesia. We don't love to put these patients back under general anesthesia. So let's say you want to treat the patient at 38 weeks. They're now out of the intubation. They're on room air. You really try to avoid putting them back under general anesthesia if you can. So we use the injection to get them to this 55-week threshold where they may be more sturdy from a cardiorespiratory standpoint to undergo anesthesia. The other factor is they get harder to examine around that age. So you can wrestle a baby at 38 weeks. They grow very fast, and at 55 weeks, they're already kicking around, and they're very hard to look in their eyes. So that's the time where you don't mind putting them under anesthesia because you need to get a good look anyway. The other factor is, as an outpatient, that's usually the cross threshold for when they need to stay in the hospital. So our hospital has about a 55-week limit and up to 60-week limit if there's any concerns by anesthesia. But it's very nice for patients not to stay overnight in the hospital for these procedures, and it can be a day procedure. And especially if it's a second or third child, having a parent in the hospital overnight with one of the babies, or if it's a single mother, is a really big difficulty. So that allows them not to have to stay overnight in the hospital. So it's kind of the perfect sweet spot. The other factor is that's right when the anti-VEGF medication may be wearing off. The average age of treatment is about 36 weeks. So that's right when things are starting to wear off plus a few weeks. So if it's really reactivating, you'd be able to tell. So that's really the sweet spot for the laser. In our practice pattern survey, there is about an 80% rate of laser after injection. So most people are injecting initially and then lasering later. The other factor is that it's much easier to do the injections. So we can just bring the injections over or order them from the hospital pharmacy. The procedure is very quick. It's no general anesthesia or sedation. We can do it just on an awake baby. We put in a numbing eye drop, a cleaning solution, and then quick injection. So from our standpoint, it's also quite easy. It can be done in 5 minutes, while a laser actually takes usually about 30 minutes.
So you can actually, that baby who just has some numbing drops, who's just like looking all over the place, they can't follow any commands, right? This is a brand new, I mean, not brand new because they were born, premature, but, 30-something week gestational age infant. And you have to find this like very, 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 very small spot that's not the lens or has any blood vessels or whatnot. How do you guys do that?
Yeah, so there's actually a couple good tricks I've developed over time. Number one, there was a paper that showed that you can inject with a very small needle. So the needle's even shorter, which mitigates risk of hitting the lens. So it's just big enough to get through the sclera. So even if you happen to be in the wrong area, you're probably unlikely to hit the lens. The other one is that I turn all the lights on, and babies really hate lights, especially if their eyes are dilated. So often they will look up or have a Bell's reflex, and they'll stay there. And so even if you're unable to move the eye yourself or instruct them where to look, they generally find their way away from the lights and they'll hold it there. And so it is pretty possible, and it's not too hard. The other thing we do is we'll have an instrument in the other hand, a Q-tip or a small metal instrument. And if needed, we could move the eye with one hand and then inject the eye with the other hand. So it's actually a pretty surprisingly simple procedure, even though it's an injection in the eye on a baby that can move their eye around.
Yeah, it just seems wild, that's all.
So with the anti-VEGF, I'm wondering about the wearing off. So once it wears off, the pressures that still cause the neovascularization is still there. But I mean, potentially, could you continue to give anti-VEGF like multiple times? And is there some point where those pressures for neovascularization goes away?
Yes, and it's actually one of the biggest controversies we have currently. So let's say you give the anti-VEGF medication and the retina doesn't fully vascularize. There's a big controversy of whether you need to laser or not. So in our high-income countries, many people do the laser to prevent problems. We have the resources. We can take the patient to anesthesia. We have a high concern about medical legal problems. In lower-resource countries, they actually don't have some of these concerns or resources. And so their rates of laser after injection are very low. And we're doing a study in India on some of their data and finding they do have pretty good outcomes even with a single injection. Even if there is avascular retina, as long as you get them through that high period with neovascularization, as long as you can get the retina, you know, three quarters vascularized and decrease the angiogenic drive just enough, they do pretty fine in the long term. The difficulty is examining the patients throughout that time period, but the reality is that most patients, even with a single injection, would do very well without laser treatment in the long run. Now, again, we're going to be talking off topic here, non-guideline based, but there's actually some people who believe that in these very low resource countries with poor oxygenation and no ROP screening, given the safety of injections, that you could even consider giving every neonate an injection, and that would actually be beneficial overall, because if you could train someone to do it, even without eye exams, because of the safety of the injections and how good of an effect it has. Of course, the goal is to get oxygen blenders to these countries and to get telemedicine screening and do it all the right way. But it is a theory that's out there as an alternative approach if you can't get to that point.
Can you talk about kind of, I mean, I was fortunate enough in medical school to do a retina specialist rotation with like an adult ophthalmologist. So I feel like I saw a fair share of intravitreal injections, but those were like 65 plus year old adults. Now that we're talking about like a fresh newborn, you know, can you talk about kind of how your conversation about treatment is with the parents? Because I can imagine, I mean, if somebody's coming to my eye with a needle, it gives me the heebie-jeebies. But like, I can only imagine new parents who have this newborn there. They're worried. They're scared. How can we help with this conversation?
Yeah. So it actually starts from the beginning. And like all surgery in ophthalmology, I take a very conservative approach. And I usually require multiple visits or discussions to get the point across because it's such a difficult topic to grasp, even for doctors and medical students and residents. Could you imagine being a layperson worried about all these other things and then trying to figure out about neovascularization and retinopathy of prematurity? So we started from the very beginning and using very simple terms. So today, for example, I saw two 24-weekers and a 23-weeker for their first exam. And what I do is I try to quote some of the data for the patients right at the beginning and say, okay, if you're 23-week-old, our general experience is about 25% to 40% of patients will need treatment for ROP. And I just leave it at that. And I say, we can discuss that as we get further, closer to the time. Then what I do is, let's say I see stage one and stage two, and it's a young patient with high risk factors, and we're kind of getting closer to that treatment. Then I may introduce the topic a little further and say, we have medications that we can administer into the eye that can help with the treatment. I try to avoid the term, the trigger terms right away, like injection or needle in the eye. And then we kind of get there on the third or fourth discussion that we use a small needle. And what I always emphasize, even with the exams and the injections, is that we actually do these on adults awake. So like you said, you shadowed an adult retina specialist for diabetic retinopathy. The patients come in, no sedation, no anesthesia, one numbing drop or numbing gel, injection, walk out, no patch, no antibiotics, nothing. So that, I think, helps them say, okay, they're not really feeling pain. They may cry because of the lights. They may feel a small pinch. But I always even liken it back to the rest of the thing and say, well, you know, even the IV probably hurt more than the injection in the eye. And that, I think, usually decreases some of the stress levels. And again, emphasizing that we currently think the vision is normal. And what we're doing is we're trying to preserve that. Because when they hear about retinopathy and prematurity and the stages, they're thinking, oh, no, there's an eye problem and my child is going to be blind. And I overemphasize that actually currently the vision is, we think, normal. And so what we're doing is trying to keep that vision. And I think that helps the mental aspect is, okay, we're actually ahead of the game right now. And we just want to stay ahead. And that really, I think, can at least give the parents some level of calm in the whole situation.
And that's, I think, a really good segue to kind of talking about the future a little bit, you know. So let's say our patient got an injection. Let's just even start back before that, right? So we have our patient here, Austin, 28-week, or has retinopathy of prematurity, requires an injection, gets one, you know, identified in the NICU, and gets one right before they leave. What, you know, obviously we're going to see these patients in clinic. So what should our outpatient pediatricians know, and kind of what's going on in the background from an ophthalmology standpoint, and what should we know as the general pediatricians? Then we'll get into the nitty gritty.
Yeah, so let's start with the 28-weeker who doesn't get an injection. What happens to those patients? So let's say you end up vascularizing pretty normally. We usually recommend a outpatient pediatric ophthalmology visit around 1 year of age. The reason being is that premature patients are more likely to have refractive errors or need glasses, with most likely being nearsighted. Now, that's a whole different conversation because this is happening in the general public at quite a high rate. In Asia and in the U.S., it's even being called an epidemic with the rate of nearsightedness because of potentially all the near work that we're doing. But that's how our general follow-up is. So we do recommend patients who were screened for retinopathy of prematurity should at some point see a ophthalmologist, usually at about a year, and potentially going forward. So we've actually seen late reactivation. So we talked about how if there is still some avascular retina, that can still promote angiogenic growth factors. This can reactivate actually even in adulthood if there's still avascular retina. And we've seen that a couple times. So we usually recommend these patients who had a stage two, let's say it didn't get treated but was stage two, still follow up with an ophthalmologist because there can be issues later on. Normally, retinal detachments occur at age 60-ish in the adult population. If you've had retinopathy of prematurity and avascular retina, the peripheral retina that didn't get blood flow is weaker. And we found in our recent study that the retinal detachments that happen in this population, it's actually usually around age 20 to 30. And so we monitor those areas for small holes in the retina or weakening that we could reinforce with laser. So stage zero patients, usually just a regular follow-up for glasses. Stage two, more continued followed up for holes and potential detachments. And now let's say you were treated for retinopathy of prematurity. These patients are usually followed on a 2 to 3 to 4 week basis right as they leave the NICU. So they can expect a lot of appointments with ophthalmologists, and it is important to help them get there. These patients have a lot going on, and they're very high risk to miss appointments. And we don't always have the resources because of our patient volumes to keep track of everyone, although we try. We send certified letters if they miss a lot of appointments. We have an ROP tracking system. But even still, in a lot of lower resource settings, they can fall through the cracks. So if you're the pediatrician seeing these patients and you noticed, oh, you were treated for ROP, but you haven't seen an ophthalmologist in 5 weeks, that's usually a sign they should probably go back or contact someone from there.
Awesome. No, that's actually very, very helpful for us you know, to at least be know when they're supposed to see ophthalmology, so we'll know if they missed or didn't miss, or, you know, however long it's supposed to be. Is there anything you kind of mentioned, refractory errors and things like that? Any other complications that we should see that's not directly related to retinopathy of prematurity, but more ophthalmologic based that comes with this?
Sometimes they're more likely to get cataracts with the laser procedure, which is whitening of the lens of the eye. That's pretty rare. But a common thing that you may see is actually strabismus, which is turning in or out of the eyes where the eye's not focusing in the same direction. And that can be from a variety of causes. There's some that's linked that we don't know exactly why. Some are related to the prematurity, maybe disparities in how the muscles grow. So there's a muscle on kind of each side of the eye, and if one grows stronger than the other, the eye may deviate to one side. The other is that if there's any issues with the retina itself, if the macula or fovea get dragged because of those abnormal blood vessels, the eye can turn to try to compensate for that. The treatments usually are patching the eye, fixing any glasses prescription, but also those muscles can be moved with surgery to realign the eyes. The importance of that, and just in general for strabismus, is that if the eye is not seeing as well or it's turned out, it will not form the connection with the brain, and it will actually lose vision over time. And what you can do is if you straighten the eye out, the vision can come back. So let's say, and that's the term you may hear, lazy eye. So if an eye is turned out and you get a lazy eye, if you fix it or you patch the good eye, it can actually gain some of the vision back. So that's one thing to look out for in these patients, is eyes drifting out or lazy eyes would be something to note. I actually don't fix those as a retina specialist, but I'll often tell the patients when I see them once they're done with ROP screening, hey, your next appointment's in a year with pediatric ophthalmology. But the one thing to look out for is if you notice the eyes are deviating, let me know and I'll set you up an appointment.
So should our like pediatricians or pediatric healthcare providers, should they be getting, like, once the child is able to do it, like the Snellen eye chart, would they be checking like visual acuities on these ROP kids, like to screen for maybe like amblyopia or something like that?
So normally these kids should still follow up with a pediatric ophthalmologist, but now, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe now pediatrics are doing spot vision testing and some of these headset-based vision screening programs within their clinics. And I would definitely recommend that on these patients. So if you're screening any patients already or pediatric patients, these are tests to do on these retinopathy of prematurity patients in particular.
And then kind of backtracking a little bit, we want them to follow up with pediatric ophthalmology, but we were talking about how sometimes there's like so many barriers to care that they miss follow-ups. Would it be ever appropriate for like a rural or underserved area, could they ever see like an optometrist for a follow-up, like a spot follow-up if they have a change, or we like all the time go see the pediatric ophthalmologist?
Yeah, definitely. I think optometrists are a great resource, and there's many more of them than ophthalmologists. And actually, for things like glasses, many of them are better than ophthalmologists because they do that all the time, especially if they have experience in pediatrics. There are specific even pediatric optometrists who are a great resource for these patients as an initial screening. They'll also dilate the eyes. They can also take a look at the back. Some optometrists, just like ophthalmologists, are not used to seeing any pediatric patients, and they may struggle with these. So I would say a pediatric eye care provider, whether it be an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, is a great place to start in these settings.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that might be helpful for some patients, especially. Moving on kind of to the prognosis. So what is, like, would you say the long-term vision potential in these patients? I know it can range, but let's say we're talking to our patients' parents right now in the NICU, what would you kind of say?
So it's generally very good. And I think one of the things that hurts about retinopathy of prematurity is it's really become a preventable condition in high resource areas. So if you catch it, you treat it appropriately, injection plus laser, you usually don't lose vision in any patient, even the very premature patients. There are some still who can progress, but it's quite rare. And so I always try to counsel the patients that even if we're doing lasers, even if we're doing injections, yes, there is a risk of vision loss, but I expect a good outcome. I expect normal vision. I expect with glasses, normal vision. I expect if everything systemically works out, you to have vision to drive a car, to do everything you need to do in school, to read the college textbooks or iPads. So I try to emphasize that the prognosis in these high resource countries is good. The difficulty is in these low resource countries or even low resource areas of the United States is that there is patients who are going blind from ROP, and it's kind of, it hurts a little bit knowing that we have the ability to treat these. And the question is, why is this happening? It's usually a knowledge transfer gap in the eye care providers that are working in these areas that don't see this very often, maybe treating too late. I think when we started out more with laser, it's more destructive and there's more side effects, so we'd wait a little bit long to treat these patients. Also, the laser itself has a little bit of a learning curve where it's not that easy to perform. And so there can be areas that are not lasered appropriately. So there is a knowledge transfer. There is a skills deficit in some of these areas, and that's where patients are still losing vision. And of course, in the lower resource countries, it's because potentially they're not even being screened. There's too much oxygen. By the time they see an eye care provider, it's too late. The retina is already detached. So if everything is managed appropriately, we actually expect perfectly good vision in these patients going forward.
And just a question about actually how they lose vision, right? The retina, we learned that the retina is used, connects to the optic nerve that sees, and that's where you see most of, or that's how you see, you know, the things that we look for. We talked about the central area of the macula has a lot of that central vision. And then we talked about how retinal detachment occurs from these blood vessels essentially growing out and pulling the retina with it. Are we losing vision in all these cases from partial or full retinal detachments, or are we losing it for some other effect on the retina?
Yes, it's usually from the retinal detachments. Now, there's some subtle vision loss that's been reported even in stage 3. So when you have stage 3 and just the blood vessels growing, it can pull the retina a little bit, but not maybe enough to pull it off. But even the stretching of the retina or the dragging probably subtly decreases the vision. Maybe not a lot. They probably get around. They probably do fine. Maybe they retain driving vision, but they probably lose things like contrast sensitivity, reading speed, and maybe some functional vision. And that's why I think going forward, we'll probably be treating earlier is my guess in the next 5 to 10 years, given the safety of these injections. And we don't necessarily even want to wait for that point. Previously, because how destructive the treatments were or how difficult they were to perform, we were really waiting until more advanced disease to get to that point. I think going forward, we'll be treating patients much earlier that we think are high risk. And if we have better research, we will be able to figure out who the people are that are going to progress, just like we do in diabetes. You know, instead of treating patients after they have an end-stage nephropathy, we should try to predict who's going to get there with A1C or other biomarkers and treat those patients with medical treatment, preventative care before they get there. The other wrench I'd like to throw into the gearbox here is genetics. So the question you may ask is, well, why does your 128-weeker get ROP in the same NICU while someone else with the same amount of oxygen who's 28 weeks does not get ROP? And we're finding there's a variety of risk factors for retinopathy of prematurity and retinopathy of prematurity progression. But there are genetics in play. So there are other retinopathies associated with pediatrics. One is familial exudative vitreoretinopathy, which is associated with a variety of genetic mutations that lead to abnormal blood vessel development. And there's classic signs of that. And it was traditionally thought to be in term infants and separate from ROP. However, with the advent of genetic testing and the ability to test these patients more frequently, we've often found in some cases where you say, oh, well, that patient wasn't that premature, and you do the genetic testing and you think it's ROP, they may have a mutation for these other conditions. And what likely there is potentiating factors that, okay, yes, they were premature. They probably have some drive for ROP, but on top of that, they have one of these mutations that also lead to abnormal blood vessel development. So I think the lines between retinopathy and prematurity and genetic-based pediatric vessel abnormalities are blurring a little bit, and that may explain why some patients still progress, even despite being not that premature or not that low birth weight. And there's been quite a few papers on this subject. So, and it's important to recognize some of those. So the difference is that in the true retinopathy of prematurity, once it kind of gets treated, once it vascularizes, you usually don't get problems after the fact. While these familial cases, because they're genetic mutations, they can lead to abnormal blood vessel development and progression even down the line, and maybe require even further monitoring into adulthood. So that's kind of the newer area in retinopathy of prematurity and pediatric retinas is looking at genes or other risk factors that are associated with the variable phenotypic expression in these cases.
Very cool. Very interesting. Is there any main take-home points you want our listeners to walk away from this episode with, or anything you want to plug?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. So I would say, kind of in summary, retinopathy of prematurity, although it's a concerning condition, it gives a lot of stress to parents and pediatricians, is generally a preventable disease. So adequate consultation, follow-up treatment usually will retain good vision. With that said, it's still one of the leading causes of childhood blindness in the world. And what we're doing now, and I think what's happening across other fields of medicine, is how do we bridge that gap? And I think a few ways to do that are with telemedicine. So using our experts who are used to seeing this in high resource areas to help the low resource areas, using potentially AI to help diagnose these patients. But more importantly, educating these countries and gathering their own data. So, you know, what are the rates of ROP in these countries and which babies are getting them? Who should be screened? What are your screening guidelines? Do they need to be updated? You know, we actually did a review of global ROP screening guidelines and found that many countries actually do not even have ROP screening guidelines. So I think we need a global collaborative effort in NICUs, pediatric societies, the AAP to pediatric societies in Africa, to develop these guidelines with ROP experts and the infrastructure around oxygen blending, screening, survivability, to help prevent a blindness that really should not happen. And that's probably the next frontier going forward for these conditions. It's going to be on the rise. So we know that premature births, the survivability is increasing worldwide. So this is going to be coming all over the place, especially for patients who immigrate to the country. So it's something to be aware of, that it's definitely coming. And even in our own NICUs, more and more 23, 22, 24-weekers are surviving. And retinopathy of prematurity is going to be a very prominent condition and part of these patients' lives going forward. The other thing I would just suggest is, ophthalmologists are generally a pretty fun-loving group of people, and we don't mind talking about it. We don't mind being consulted, even for non-retinopathy of prematurity conditions. Some of the things we see is, you know, patients referred too late, or, you know, they try to get managed in pediatric emergency departments. Just call the ophthalmologist if it's an eye problem. If you're not sure, feel free. We're always available and happy to help in these cases.
Thank you so much for all the time you spent with us tonight. I think this is the most I've ever talked about ROP in my like 20 years of medicine, and I learned so much. I don't know why I just learned so much. Thank you so much. I'm very sure our listeners enjoyed this a lot and learned a lot. So we should probably make sure that we have you back for other retinopathy discussions.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and I hope this has been helpful for everybody in the pediatric NICU medical student community.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer, Dr. Trevor Hoag, for this episode and our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Trevor.
And this has been Chris the G-Man Chew. Thank you and good night. And of course, if you made it to the end, you're going to be blessed with another poem written by AI. This one's titled, A Blink Too Soon. In the darkness of a womb's retreat, blood vessels grow with measured beat until that day too swift, too near, when tiny eyes too light appear. Retina's fragile, not quite done. A premature journey has begun. Blood vessels paused in their tracks, unsure whether to advance or fall back. From center to edge, they should gently spread, but oxygen's dance leads them astray instead. ROP stages from 1 through 5 tell how these precious eyes will thrive. The NICU team will careful skill screens every preemie with watchful will. Through dilated eyes, they seek to find any signs that might leave vision behind. For some, just time is all they need for blood vessels to complete their deed. For others, lasers trace with care or medicine injected there. Parents wait with hearts unsure, will their child's sight remain secure? Myopia may come or eyes misaligned, future challenges of a different kind. From graduation day and years beyond, the pediatrician keeps the watchful bond. For these small eyes that blinked too soon under NICU's artificial moon. Thank you. Good night, guys.